This session is on Jesus as the fulfillment of the law and the whole story of God and how you can be too. But before we do, I want to just kind of set the stage for why I think this matters a lot. There are a couple of reasons why I think so. The Sermon on the Mount is one of my kind of great passions. I'm trying to give my life to living out the Sermon on the Mount. It is the most important teaching in my life, and I'm trying to get better and better at it. So it matters from that perspective, and this is kind of the heart of the sermon. But it also matters from the story of God perspective. The last 3 years, I've been writing a curriculum for churches that's all about the story of God. It's over 50 lessons. I've just been pouring myself into this, and it has been amazing. So today, in just a few minutes, I want to introduce you to that story of God and show how the whole point of the entire thing is Jesus. And that if you get him, you too can fulfill that law that Jesus talks about. But it's a problem, I think, that we need to face for a number of reasons. And this gets into some research that I've been reading. This is research about American young people who are teenagers. So any American teenagers in the room? Okay, that's almost everybody. American teenagers in the room were put through some questions, and then they followed up with some interviews. And here's what they were trying to find. American teenagers, what do you think of religion? What is Christianity? And here's what they found, that a significant portion of young people in America, their religion is actually only tenuously Christian. There's a book published after this. It's called Almost Christian. You know what that means? It's not really Christian. It's something less than Christian. And in fact, they describe it as a different religion altogether. They call it Christian moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, we're not going to get into that. Here's what it means, though. Most teenagers in the United States think Christianity is that you need to be nice so that you can be happy, and then one day, if you're good enough, you'll go to heaven. And I'm here to say that is not Christianity. Christianity is not about being nice and happy so that one day you can go to heaven. That's not it. But the majority of Christian young people think that's what Christianity is. Here's some follow-up research. The opening pages of the woman who led the interviews. She says, "Let me save you some trouble. Here's the gist of what you're about to read. American young people, that's you and my generation, are theoretically fine with religious faith. But it does not concern them very much, and it is not durable enough to survive long after they graduate from high school." Here's what they found, that people who believe that Christianity is about being nice and happy, one day going to heaven, they say they don't stay in church. They're gone by the time they graduate high school. Once they have a choice, they're done. And here's the thing about Christianity. There are serious consequences if you treat Jesus as if he's an option or an add-on to your life instead of treating him as if he's the entire reason for being. All right, I have a lot more here, but here's the personal happiness, interpersonal niceness. I'm going to move through that quickly because I think there's one more slide. Yeah, here it is. So she follows up with all these interviews. And she asks some teenagers specifically, sits down with them or calls them on the phone, and she says, "Here's what I learned, that young people are not able to talk about faith. They say sports, pop culture, math, history, they're really articulate in a lot of things, but when it comes to faith, they act like no one has ever talked to them before." She says, "Some of their conversations felt like the first time any adult had ever asked them about why faith was important to them." And she said it was particularly a problem. It was a problem when they tried to put their faith in the words. The difficulty escalated when the conversation turned to particulars. Now, I read that and I thought, yeah, particulars. It's really hard to know theories of atonement or, like, what does transubstantiation mean? Particulars are hard. I get it. But that's not the kind of particulars that they were talking about. You see it? The name Jesus was especially absent from our interviews. You see what this means. That when Christian young people defined Christianity, they did not mention Jesus. shocking to me. It was the most shocking page in the book to me. That somehow Jesus was missing from the faith. And it was replaced with niceness and happiness. I'm very troubled by this. And I think looking at the teachings of Jesus can help us. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at Matthew chapter 5, verses 17, 18, 19, and 20. And we're going to break up into four groups to do that for just a few minutes. Here's group one right here. Can you kind of come in? Y'all are going to look at verse 17. Any of y'all tight or all of y'all tight? All of you. Okay, let's go from you over. That's group two. Y'all are going to look at verse 18. And then from you, and I'm sorry, glasses, what's your name?
Brittany.
So from you and then Brittany over. Y'all are verse 19, and then what is your name?
Bridget.
Y'all are verse 20. Here's what I want y'all to do. I'm gonna set a timer for about 2 minutes, and y'all are gonna answer, what's the point of this passage? Just your verse, and there's gonna be some key words. I want you to change those words out and rephrase them in your own words. Okay? So what's the point? And then paraphrase it. All right? Y'all go to your groups. You have about 2 minutes to go through each verse. If one person could read the verse to the entire group, that would be great. All right? Let's see it. All right, who's reading in this one?
We just read it.
Okay, great. You're done already? All right, walk through some of that with me. So, y'all know abolish, what that means. And then y'all know fulfill, what that means. Okay. Can you find... do y'all have a good paraphrase for it? Okay. Does he just show what they mean, or does he do something even more than that?
He's not trying to abolish any laws. He's just trying to state them, help him interpret what they are, what they mean.
Okay. Yeah.
Instead of just thinking.
All right. There's another phrase, though. Law and prophets. What if the law and the prophets don't just refer to the commands, but they refer to the story? Or does that change anything? We'll talk through that in just a minute. All right, where's group two? Are y'all group two?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just eavesdrop. Y'all go ahead. As you were.
You can't run away from, like, what's bound to happen.
That's verse 18?
Yeah, I can read again. Heaven and earth may disappear, but I promise you not even a period or comma will ever disappear from the law. Everything written in it must happen. So we were saying, even though if like heaven and earth like is not here anymore, like the law will still be the law no matter what.
What's a modern way of saying that? Is there a phrase that says like that's never gonna happen? You don't think of any? No. Never going to happen. Or what about like something like when pigs fly? Do y'all know that phrase?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it might happen, but come on. What's another one like that? I'll let y'all think of it. All right, verse 19. How are y'all doing? Okay, so y'all are ready to go? You got a good paraphrase?
Sure.
Verse 20, how are y'all? Yeah, I like the confidence back there. All right. You can stay where you are, but look up here. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to get the person who read it in your group to read it aloud to our group, starting with verse 17. Everybody follow along. Matthew 5:17. Did you read? What is your name?
Briar.
Do you mind reading verse 17?
Sure. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them.
18. What is your name?
Talia. Sorry, I lost
it. You got to finish this text first?
What? No.
you're looking it up.
You're trying to pronounce something.
Yeah. But.
I'm sorry.
Heaven and earth may disappear, but I promise you not even a period or comma will ever disappear from the law. Everything written in it must happen.
And then verse 19. Who read that? Tell me your name.
Gavin.
Thank you. And then last one. Tell me your name.
Ashley.
Can you read verse 20 for us?
Yes, sir. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven.
Okay. Let's go back through now, and I want to talk to y'all. Group one, y'all can chime in, but Briar, what's the point of verse 17? What does it mean that Jesus says, I didn't come to abolish the law and the prophets, but I came to fulfill them? What's the big point that I could fit in this section?
He's basically laying it out for them. He said, don't get in your heads that I'm not here to change the way that God has instituted it. I'm here to fulfill what God has already brought to the table.
Yeah.
But in a way that you can better understand it.
Okay, so tell me what abolish means.
Get rid of.
Okay, so he's not destroying good. What's another word for fulfill? What's that? Accomplish good. Yeah, that's even another word that shows up later. What else? What about complete? Not to destroy what? The law and the prophets, but to complete them. All right, good. Verse 19. Verse 18. Talia? What's the point?
So basically, no matter, even if earth and heaven destroy, the law will still be the law no matter what.
Yeah, so until when?
Eternally.
Wait, he puts a statement on it, right? Until all is accomplished. Yeah. So it's not passing away. What was another way to say that? Give me a good paraphrase. What's that? Okay, yeah. Yeah, we talked about that one. Have y'all heard the phrase, when pigs fly? It's like, it's not going to happen. When hell freezes over, that was another one I thought of. It's not going to happen until it's complete. So, when pigs fly, all right, until it's accomplished. We'll have to talk about what that means. Verse 19, Gavin, help me out. What's the point? Yeah. So what would be something least in the kingdom? Like one of the commands. He says the least of these commands. He's talking about these, right? The 613 laws. He says if you relax one of the least of these, what does it mean to relax one of those?
It means to not teach it as often as some of the other ones. Like, let's say, murder or adultery. Those are taught more above all the other ones. Then that's
sure. Brittany, what are you thinking?
Well, I think that also it means that you relax. So if someone tells you do not do this, and you think, well, I know my mom told me don't eat before dinner, but if I eat one cookie, she won't know. You kind of revert it to where it fits your lifestyle and what you want to do.
Yeah, it fits your lifestyle. I like that. So he's saying, do not make it to where it just fits you. What happens if you do?
Well, basically, it's if you do, then you're going to be considered at least in heaven. But, you're going to, if you do it, others see that in you, and you teach them that. So then you're going to all fall away because you're not teaching them what's
yeah, right. Yeah. So there's a consequence. You use that phrase, fall away. The least in the kingdom is what Jesus is casting out those later in the Gospel of Matthew. So this is not who you want to be. So if the claim is, I came to fulfill the law, so you had better not relax the law. If you do, you're actually out. You're not one of my people. There's a consequence. Right? I'll use that word here. Consequence. All right, verse 20. Go ahead. Ashley, right?
Yes, sir. It's basically saying that you should have more faith than the scribes and Pharisees at the time.
Yeah, so tell me about the scribes and Pharisees as best you can. Were they perceived to be good people?
They were perceived to be righteous.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so there's a little hypocrisy going on. So he's saying you have to be better than the people known for being great. That's pretty tough. Do you know any people who are, they just have a reputation for being really righteous, but they don't claim to follow Jesus? I thought of Gandhi. Have you all heard of him? I mean, he was not a follower of Jesus. He's not a Christian. He doesn't even claim to be. But people look at him and say, wow, that guy's great. It's kind of like Jesus is doing that, saying, imagine the greatest people in your society and how righteous they are. He says, but they're not following me. You've got to be better than them. So if the consequence for not following the law is falling away, the consequence for following the law means you're in the kingdom. You're great in the kingdom. But then he expands that claim to show us what he says in verse 20. All right, here's how I put it in my... That's not what I thought I had there. So he expands the claim to say, you have to be greater than the non-followers of Jesus. All right. Good. Thank you all for doing that. Now, here's how I phrase those points, starting with verse 18. So group one, Briar and the rest of the crew. I said, when you read the Bible, number one, the entire story of God, from Genesis to Revelation, it points to Jesus. It does. It points to Jesus. And I'm going to spend a little while showing you how that works. How does the entire story of God point to Jesus? Now notice, I'm not saying that all the 613 commands you have to keep to follow Jesus. I'm using a different word. I'm using the word story. And here's why. Because when we look at the Old Testament law, it's not just a list of rules, the 613 commands. It's also the first five books of the Bible. Genesis is not a book of rules. It's a story. And it's a story of God. It's the story of God saving the world from sin. It's his effort to bless all the peoples of the world through one family. I want to tell you that story. It starts Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God... Anybody know that? I thought y'all would finish it for me. Okay, good. So y'all are here. He creates the heavens and the earth. And it's really cool how interlocked they are. Right? God is in the garden walking with Adam and Eve. This is amazing. Adam and Eve are image bearers, and they reflect and represent God. God made a creation. He says, I want y'all to go finish it. I want y'all to fill it up. I want y'all to multiply and rule and have dominion. All the things that I do, you now get to do. But what happens? Sin. Okay, so that's a short answer. Very good. Here, sin happens. And I'm picturing it like a fall. And sometimes we call it that. Adam and Eve, they take the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they say, God, you don't get to define good and evil anymore. How did you put it, Brittany, earlier? I'm going to do it in a way that fits into my lifestyle. That's the first sin. What about Adam and Eve's kids? Tell me about Cain and Abel. What do they do? Yeah, short answer, they murder each other. At least one of them does. Yeah. Y'all remember that story? And by the way, that's the next thing Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount. This is the human problem. You get sin. I'm going to put this into my life. And then you get murder. And then it gets so bad that God wipes the earth clean with water in the days of Noah. But then Noah, still not great. Noah, he gets drunk, and there's this really disturbing scene with Noah and one of his sons. I'm not going to go into details. And then it builds and builds until one final moment. And there's this city called Babel. And what do they do in Babel?
They make those great big towers.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, they say, we're going to go up to God. And then God looks at him and says, I've got to come down there. And God is the God who comes down because people are the ones trying to go up and replace him. But this word, Babel, is the Hebrew word for Babylon. Let's tuck that away. And out of Babylon, God calls one guy. So if this is the story of humanity, Babylon, fallen, sinful, murderous, angry, violent humanity, God has a rescue plan. And the rescue plan is the family of Abraham. Abraham is a guy from Babylon. His father and mother, they worshiped the gods of Babylon. They were idolaters. But God says, I want you to leave your father, leave your people, and I want you to go to the land. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you the land. I'm going to give you a great name. I'm going to give you a family like a nation. And he says, I'm going to give you kings in chapter 17. Abraham, we call this a covenant. I'm going to do this. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to bless the world through your family. And so we've gone from heaven and earth and all of society, these global scenes, and now we just focus in on one guy's family. Abraham has a son. Do you remember his son's name? Yeah, Ishmael. Let's ignore him for a moment. And then Isaac. And then God says, I want you to kill your son. He actually says, I want you to take your one and only beloved son, and I want you to put him on the altar. You have this scene where the covenant needs a one and only beloved son to fulfill it. And then Abraham leaves that place saying, the Lord will provide for himself a sacrifice. The family of Abraham continues. Isaac has a son, Jacob, and Esau. We're going to set him aside for a moment. Jacob has 12 sons. One of them is Joseph. Where does Joseph end up? He ends up, it's almost like another Babylon. We're back now. Abraham's family, the rescue plan for this problem, is now in Egypt. Just another wicked, human, angry, violent empire. And then God raises up a deliverer in the days of Egypt. Who is it? Moses. Good. And Moses, he brings these 10 plagues on Egypt. What's the last one? The 10th one. Yeah, the death of the firstborn. So that's replaced with a lamb, and then they pass through the sea, and then they go up to Mount Sinai, and Moses receives the law, and God says, this is how I'm going to make you holy. You're going to become what he calls a kingdom of priests, just like those image bearers that connected heaven and earth before. That's your job here. But of course, they fail. They do the same things that people have always done. And it gets so bad that it says at the end of the book of Judges, it says everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Why? Because there was no king. So God gives him a king. He fails. But then God gives him another king. Who is that? The great king of Israel. All right, David. And God makes David a special promise. And in 2 Samuel chapter 7, David says, God, I have this amazing palace, and you're living in, he's still living in the tent. God's presence is in a tent. And he's, I want to make you a house. And God says, I'm flattered. I don't need a house. I'm the God of heaven and earth. I don't live in houses. But let me make you a house, David. And he doesn't mean a house with walls and a roof. He means a legacy, a family. And he calls it an everlasting kingdom. He says, David, I promise you, one of your sons is going to reign forever and ever. And he uses this word, anointed one. The son. Let's hold on to that. So we have all these moments. Great hope, and then failure. Great hope, and then failure. Great hope, and then what happens to David's family line and the king's? Failure. I mean, it's the next son, Solomon. The nation's divided. He goes after other wives. He invites the Babylonians and the Egyptians to come, and he marries some of their daughters. Solomon, what are you doing? You're doing the same problem that humans have always had. And so God ends up punishing them with what we call exile. He takes Israel and they're punished. And then finally, the son of David, the last king, is killed. And it looks like the promises are done. Except there are these prophets who, even though there's no king from the line of David, and even though they're not even living in the land anymore, where are they living? Who goes and captures them? Babylon. So they're back here. Even though they live in Babylon, God sends these prophets. And the prophets say, take heart, people of God. God made a promise and he's not going to give up on it now. God made a promise and he's going to bless the world. And he said he was going to do it through your family and he still is. He says, we need a new lamb to come who's also a king. And so Isaiah calls him a suffering servant, this lamb who's going to endure the wounds of the people. He says, we need, Isaiah calls him an anointed one. It's the word Messiah. In Greek, it's the word Christos, Christ. We need a Christ to come to bring in God's kingdom to fulfill this. And Isaiah says, when he does it, he's going to bring, ultimately, the new heavens and the new earth. But how do we get from here in Babylon to here? And it's one man, the fulfillment of the entire story. It's Jesus. Look in your Bibles at Matthew chapter 1. This is the first page of the New Testament. If you're just reading through the old story, we can get lost. But these are the five key chapters. Creation, covenant, law, kingdom, exile. Those are the five chapters of the story that Jesus fulfills. And look at it in chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy, here's a really cool thing. If you care about Greek words, you'll know this one. This word genealogy is the word Genesis. This is the Genesis. This is the new creation, the new beginning. It's the Genesis of Jesus. Jesus, his name means Yahweh saves. Who's Yahweh? He's this God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Why do they need a savior? Because they're in exile, and the prophet said there was going to be one. This is the Genesis, the beginning of Yahweh the Savior, the Christ. What is that word? That's Christ and the Messiah, the Anointed One, the King. He's the Son of David and the Son of Abraham. That's just verse 1. If you don't know the story, then how can we make much sense of what's going on in the Gospel of Matthew? Even the word gospel is an Isaiah word. Gospel means God's coming home and he's going to be king. There's a new king in town. And we see that Jesus is that one. Not just through the cross, but also through the empty tomb and the resurrection. Jesus fulfills this. Notice, he also fulfills the commands. But he fulfills much more than the commands. He completes and fulfills the entire story. So, there's some conclusions we can build based on that. Number 2. That was just verse 17. Man, I could go on forever, but we have what? 2 minutes left? Anybody have the time? What is it? 11:32. Oh, 3 minutes. Okay, I'll run through these. Number 2, verse 18. Following Jesus is fulfilling the law. Jesus warns, you should not relax the law. But following Jesus is fulfilling the law. Here's how Paul puts it. He says, the law is fulfilled in one word. Anybody guess the word? Love. That's the law fulfilled in one word. Love. He says it in Galatians chapter 5, verse 14. He says, this is how you fulfill the law of Christ, when you bear one another's burdens, in chapter 6, verse 2 of Galatians. In Romans chapter 13, verses 8 through 10, he says the same thing, that love is the fulfillment of the law, because Jesus has fulfilled the law, And he now invites us to love God and love others. And when you do, you complete the story of God also. All right, number three from verse 19. Not following Jesus has eternal consequences. That is, the least, the ones who say, even to the least of the commands of following Jesus, I'm just going to relax this so it can fit into my lifestyle, like Brittany said. It says, you're going back to the wrong storyline. You're going back to the Adam and Eve, to the Cain and Abel. You're going back to the murderous, violent, angry empires. And Jesus is separate from that. And when you do that, you're no longer in the kingdom. You're no longer following Jesus. Which means, number four, that the followers of Jesus actually have to live better lives, more righteous lives than non-followers. Now, I know this is striking, because a lot of people today say that all you have to do is believe in Jesus. No, that's not true. All you have to do is have faith in Jesus. And faith always leads to actions and work. It leads to love. Because, just like the prophet said, when we have faith, God's Spirit is working on our hearts to transform us, to replace our old hard hearts, like Pharaoh, with soft hearts. That's Ezekiel 36. In Jeremiah 31, he says, when you get this new covenant story, he says, it's written on your heart. It's no longer just written on stone or tablets. That we become people who live better lives. And how is that defined? In a word, love.